If you have your Bible and would turn to Genesis chapter 38, that's where we're going to begin our lesson this morning. And for our lesson this morning, I would simply like to remind you of the stories of four women whose stories appear in the Old Testament. We're going to look at one of those stories in the book of Genesis, one of them in the book of Joshua, another one whose story appears during the time of the judges, and another one whose story appears in the time of the kings. Four women in the Bible. I'd like for us to rehearse their stories first, just to kind of get their stories back into our minds and thinking about them. And then I'd like for us to notice an interesting thing that they all seem to have in common, and then a few lessons that we can draw from their stories. The first woman is the woman whose story is found in Genesis chapter 38. And if you've never read Genesis chapter 38, it is not a pleasant story. It's not one of those stories where somebody does something good, where somebody has done something valiant and gets rewarded for it or recognized for it, or where somebody is saved from death or a great calamity is averted. No, it's a story about one of the patriarchs of Israel whose name was Judah, and about a sin that he committed. It's a very shameful story when you look at the details. The Bible says in Genesis 38 and verse 2 that Judah had gone down to the area of the Adullamites and saw a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. And she conceived and bore us another son and named him Onan. And then in verse 5, they had another son and they named him Shelah. And so Judah has three sons by this woman. The Bible says in verse 7 that the firstborn son, Ur, was an evil man, and so the Lord killed him. In verse 8, it then became the job of the secondborn son to take this widow of his brother, take her to be his wife and raise up children with her who would be considered the children of that dead husband. That was called levirate marriage later on in the law of Moses. The Bible says that the second son, Onan, refused to do it and God killed him too. Now, the impression I get is that Judah is not paying attention. Judah really doesn't think too much about what the spiritual aspects of what's going on here. All he knows is that he has now given two men to this woman, Tamar, to be husbands to this girl, and they're both now dead. He's probably thinking, you know, I don't have that many sons left. This woman's some kind of a black widow, and if I give my third son to this woman, he'll probably wind up dead too. And so Judah says to her, he says in verse 11, you're a widow twice now. Tell you what I want you to do. My third son, who is supposed to now be your husband, he's not old enough to get married. But one of these days he is going to get old enough, and so what I want you to do is I want you to go back home to your father's house, and I want you to live like a widow in your father's house, which is Judah's way of saying, I'm not going to take care of you. You're my daughter-in-law, but I'm not going to take care of you. I want you to go back home and let your father take care of you, and when my third son gets old enough to marry you, I'll give you a call. And by that Judah means, don't expect to hear from me. Well, time went by. Judah never called. This poor girl has now been widowed twice. She is facing the prospect of living the rest of her days without ever having the opportunity to bear children, which would have been a disgrace to her. And so she takes matters into her own hands. She hears one day that Shelah, the third son, is old enough now to take a wife, but Judah has never called. And so It says there that Judah was going up to Timnah, and Tamar hears that Judah's coming up that way. And so in verse 14, it says, she took a veil and wrapped herself and sat in the gateway of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah, because Judah's got to pass that way to go do the sheep shearing, and she's dressed up like a harlot, like a prostitute. Judah is coming by that way. He sees this young woman, and he propositions her. He says, how much? And they start to talk about it, and she says, well, what are you willing to pay? And he says, I'll give you a goat. I've got a lot of flocks and herds. I'll give you a goat. I don't have him with me, but I'll send him. And she says, okay, how do I know you're going to send it? Tell you what, you leave your cord and your seal and your staff here, the things that are very important to you, kind of like leaving your driver's license behind in the ancient world. You leave those with me, and then when you deliver the goat, I'll give them back to you. And so Judah says, okay, and he commits fornication with her. He then goes his own way as if nothing has happened. The girl goes back home, Tamar, and in a couple months it is determined that she is pregnant. Well, of course, her father is horrified. Here's this girl living under his house. She's obviously been sleeping around, and she's pregnant, and of course her father is just shocked that his daughter would do this kind of thing. And so he decides to purge his family of this shameful thing, and the word gets out that Tamar is pregnant, and Judah, acting like he is so self-righteous, says, yeah, she's been unfaithful. She needs to be burned. She needs to be destroyed and executed. And he's all for it. Well, it says in verse 25, while they are bringing her out to carry out the death sentence, she says, I can tell you the name of the father of my baby. It is the man to whom this cord and this seal and this staff belong. And she shows them to Judah, who's been cheering on her execution. And he looks at it and he says, whoops, this is mine. And I don't know if he realized it before then or not, but now he understands that that's my child, that that's the girl that I slept with, that I thought she was a prostitute. And he says in verse 26, she is more righteous than I. You have to understand what's going on here, folks, that I made a promise to her that I was not going to keep. I told her that I would send my son down here to be her wife, and I had no intention of keeping that. She has actually made me keep my promise now because I did not give her to my son Shelah. And so the story ends in verse 27, 28, or 29 and 30, that she gave birth to the child, and lo and behold, she's got twins. And it says in verse 28 that while she was giving birth, one of the babies stuck his hand out of the womb, and the midwife tied a scarlet thread around that hand because he's the one that came out first. But then he withdrew his hand back into his mother's womb, and the other one came out. And she called him Perez. And then the one that had the scarlet thread came out, and she called him Zerah. That's not a very flattering story by any account. It is a story of one of the patriarchs of Israel doing a horrible, rotten thing. As a matter of fact, doing two horrible, rotten things, and a woman doing a horrible, rotten thing as well. But what's interesting is that that child, Perez, grows up, and a couple more generations go by, and one of the great-great-great-great-grandchildren down the line is a man named Salmon. And Salmon eventually has a son named Boaz. Before we get to Boaz, though, let's talk about Salmon, because he has to do with the second woman that we're going to talk about today. In Joshua chapter 1, you remember that Moses is gone. Joshua is going to lead the Israelites into the land of Canaan. And he sends spies across the River Jordan to spy out the first city that the Israelites are going to have to fight, and that is the city of Jericho. It was a walled city with gates and walls and fortifications, and it was going to be a formidable challenge for the Israelites to fight these people and destroy that city. Walled cities were hard to get into. And so Joshua sends some spies in to see how big the city is, what kind of reserves they've got, how much food they've got, what size the walls are, when do they close the gates, when do they open the gates, all of that stuff you'd want to know about your enemy. And it says that while the spies were in the city, that there is a woman who recognized these men as strangers. She said, those men are not from around here. And her name was Rahab. Rahab was a prostitute. There is no indication in the story that these men had gone to visit a prostitute. But the story suggests that Rahab recognized that they were strangers. And not only does she recognize that they were strangers, but Rahab has been listening to the evening news every night. Because the news reports have been that there is a nation, a new nation in town. They are called the Israelites. And they have been over there in the plains of Moab. They have already destroyed the Moabites. They have destroyed the kingdom of Bashan. And now they're headed this way. And so Rahab invites these men to come to her house, and she sits them down and says, "Listen, I've heard the stories about you people. I know that you've conquered the Moabites. I know that you've conquered the kingdom of Bashan. And I can see what your God is doing for you. Your God is destroying every enemy that stands in front of you. And the report that I've heard is that you've set your sights on my city next, and that we're the next on your hit list. And I believe that you're going to take our city. You've done it to every other place you've been to so far. And I just know your God is with you. And I don't know how to get out of this." And so she said to the spies, "Here's what I want. I want you to keep me and my family from destruction. What I'm going to do is I'm going to keep you safe tonight." Because, you see, these spies had been recognized. They had been spotted coming into the city. And the city officials were on the lookout for them. "We heard that two strangers have come into town. We heard that there are some men here that may be looking around at our city, scoping it out, maybe planning a war." And so there was a hunt going on through the city to find these men. Rahab said to these men, "Tell you what, I will hide you in my house tonight. But when you and your army return to this place to destroy it, I want my family to be spared." And they said, "Okay, that's what we'll do." And she hid them, and she helped them to escape from the city officials. And later on in Joshua chapter 6, you recall the story that the Israelites marched around the city of Jericho 7 times. On the 7th day, they blew the trumpets and the walls fell down and the city was taken. And the Israelites destroyed that city. They destroyed all of its loot and they killed all of its people. But it says in Joshua chapter 6 and verse 26 or verse 25 that Rahab the harlot and her father's household and all she had, Joshua spared. And she has lived in the midst of Israel to this day, for she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. And so Rahab took in the spies because she believed the reports that she had been told about what God was doing with the Israelites. Now, the text of Joshua doesn't say what eventually happened to her, but remember that guy that we mentioned, his name was Salmon? He was that descendant of Tamar, the descendant of that boy that came out second but really came out first. Salmon took Rahab into his family. And apparently he took her to be his wife so that she wouldn't have to live alone. And they had a boy, and his name was Boaz. And that brings us to the third story we're going to look at today, and that is the story of Ruth. If you go in your Bible after the book of Judges to the story of Ruth, you'll remember that there was a famine in the land of Israel. There wasn't any food. The crops weren't growing. And so there was a man of Bethlehem who went to sojourn in the land of Moab to look for food. So he packed up his family and his two sons, and they went over to the land of Moab to try and find some food. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi. So Elimelech, Naomi, and the two boys, they go to the country of the Moabites, and Elimelech dies there. Well, the two boys, in the meantime, have married. The two boys marry Moabite women. One is named Orpah, the other is named Ruth. And it says they live there about 10 years. Well, the two boys then died. So there is Naomi, who is a widow, and her two daughter-in-laws, who are widows. Three women on their own. Naomi hears a report that crops are growing again in the land of Israel, and so Naomi says to her Moabite daughters-in-law, "Go back to your father's house. I don't expect you to stay with me. Even though you've married into my family, you don't have to share my hardship and my plight. I'll make do. I'll go back home, but you stay here and take care of yourself." And you'll recall that Ruth says, both of them, Orpah and Ruth, clung to Naomi and said, "We're not leaving." In Ruth chapter 1 and verse 16, "Do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. I'm not going to leave you alone." And so she determined to go back to Israel. This foreign Moabite woman says, "I'll leave my homeland and my country. I'll go live in Israel with you and take care of you." Well, you'll recall that she's a foreigner. She's a Moabitess. And so they go back to the land of Israel. And sure enough, grain is growing. But she doesn't have a husband. She doesn't have a family there. They don't have a farm. She's got no way to eat. Even though people are eating and harvesting and gathering grain, Ruth doesn't have any stake in any of that. But you'll recall that she is introduced to a man who we just heard about, the son of Salmon, named Boaz, who is a relative of Elimelech. And you remember how that story goes, that he takes care of her. He allows her to glean in his field, and he takes provisions for her. And finally, at the end of the story, he takes possession of Ruth through an interesting ceremony, and she comes into his family. Boaz and Ruth have a boy, and his name is Obed. Obed and his wife have a boy, and his name is Jesse. Jesse and his wife have another boy, and his name is David. And that brings us to the fourth woman that we want to talk about today. Her story is told to us in 2 Samuel chapter 11. David was the king of Israel. By this time, Saul was gone. David was at the height of his reign. He was ruling in righteousness and justice. Things were going about as well as they possibly could go. One evening in the springtime, David was on the roof of his house, and he saw a woman bathing, and the lust inside him was kindled. And rather than just go into his house and say, "That's not my business, I shouldn't be looking at her," he sent a messenger and said, "Who is that woman?" They said, "Well, that is Bathsheba. She's the wife of one of the generals in your army." David says, "I'd like to meet her." So she's brought to the palace, and you remember the story, they commit adultery. David probably thought that nobody will know. My palace people who were in on this, they're sworn to secrecy. They're not going to tell anybody. Bathsheba's not going to tell anybody. David may have been thinking, I was able to get away with this one. I was able to have a night of fun, and that's it. But lo and behold, Bathsheba is pregnant. And they must have found out pretty soon, right after that she was pregnant, because David says, I know what I'll do. I'll get Uriah, her husband, to come home. I'll give him a little R&R. I'll give him some leave time from the military. He'll come home. He'll sleep with his wife. 9 months later, he'll think that the baby is his, and nobody will know. And so he sends for the message, Uriah, come home. You've been out in the field a long time. You've been a good soldier. I want to give you the weekend off. Come home and spend some time at home with your wife. And Uriah, like a good soldier, says, I can't do that, King David. My men are out in the field. I can't be sleeping at my bed in Jerusalem while my men are sleeping on the ground. No, I've got to stay with them. And so David begins to worry. Now Uriah's going to find out. He's going to come home in a couple months from battle, and his wife is going to be pregnant. She's going to be showing. He's going to ask her, what have you done? And she's going to say, I slept with King David, and the secret's going to be out, and this is going to be a mess. And so what does David decide to do? He says, Uriah's got to die. And while Uriah is at home telling David that I cannot spend the weekend at my house, I'm going to go right back to the field, David says, I've got a message for you to deliver. Take this back to Joab, the commander of the army. And in the message it says, Put Uriah on the front line of the battle and then withdraw from him. And poor Uriah carries his own death sentence back to the battlefield. Joab carries out the order. Uriah gets killed. And David is finally thinking, now nobody will know. But God knew. And in 2 Samuel 12, God sent Nathan the prophet to confront David. And after he has been confronted, this is what God says to David in 2 Samuel 12 and verse 11, or verse 12, what you did secretly. But what I'm going to do to punish you, I'm going to do it in front of all Israel and under the sun. You thought that you could hide this, but I'm going to let the world know what you did, David. And for the rest of David's life, his family falls apart, and his life is filled with tears. The child that is born out of that adulterous relationship dies, but David takes Bathsheba to be his wife, and they have another child. That child, however, is not the heir to the throne of Israel. There is another child named Amnon, who is David's firstborn son. He is going to be the next king of Israel. But Amnon raped his half-sister, Tamar. And his half-brother Absalom was so angry about it that Absalom killed Amnon. So the firstborn to the throne is dead. Absalom. Well, the next child that was in line for the throne was a child named Daniel. He was David's second-born son. But apparently he died before he became a man. He's never mentioned again in the Bible after we're told about his birth. And so Absalom, David's third son, is now the heir to the throne. But you'll recall that Absalom staged a revolt. He tried to take the kingdom away from David. And in the war that resulted between David's forces and Absalom's forces, Absalom got killed. And so the number three son to the throne is dead. David's fourth-born son was a man named Adonijah. He too tried to take the kingdom away from David. And at that point, David stepped in and said, no, Adonijah, I'm not going to give the kingdom to you. I'm going to give the kingdom to my fifth-born son. That was the child that he had with Bathsheba. His name was Solomon. What all four of these women have in common is that all four of them are listed in Matthew chapter 1 in the genealogy of Jesus. And we look at those stories and we say, well, wait a minute. Tamar, who dressed herself up as a prostitute, right? And has this child. And from that relationship comes the man who takes in Rahab the harlot. She's mentioned in Matthew chapter 1, Rahab, because she has a son that takes in Ruth, a Moabitess. And I would have you recall in Deuteronomy 23 and verse 3, the Bible said that Israelites were not to marry Moabites. Ruth shouldn't even be in the story, but she has a child in this lineage, and she gives birth to David, who then has a wife named Bathsheba, the fourth woman mentioned in Jesus' genealogy, and through him comes Solomon. None of these women should be in the Bible. None of them really had a legitimate place among the holy, righteous people of God, but there they are. They are the ancestors of Jesus. And we look at that and we say, how can that be? There are four simple lessons that I would suggest to you this morning that come from these four stories and the fact that they all appear in the genealogy of Jesus. I'd like to share these four lessons with you very briefly, and then the lesson will be yours. Lesson number one, you never know how God is going to accomplish his will. You just don't know. Who in their wildest dreams, sitting way back before all of this ever started, could have said, now God has a plan. Excuse me. And what God is going to do, he's going to take the most righteous and the most holy people, and he's going to use them to bring his Savior into the world. That's how we would have written the story, but that's not how God did it. God used women like Tamar and Rahab and Ruth and Bathsheba to bring his Messiah into the world. Nobody could have guessed that God was going to do that. And there is a tremendous lesson in there for you and me, friends, that you just don't know how God is accomplishing his will. You know, we look at our lives, and sometimes our lives look like the Bible stories. They're messed up, aren't they? And we say, how in the world can this be anything remotely close to what God would want for my family or for my life or the situation I'm in? How could this be the will of God? I'm sure that people looked at Tamar and said, what in the world does she have to do with the plan of God? Or Bathsheba, or a Moabite woman, or a harlot named Rahab. And yet God said, these are the people that I'm going to use to accomplish my plan of salvation. You never know how God is going to do it. And it may very well be that hardship and that difficulty that you're facing right now, or that thing that's got you confused and you don't know what to think about it, you don't know where to go, it may be that that is the very situation that God is using right now to do something great. Don't write it off. Don't discount it. But there is a second lesson that comes from all of this, and that is that God accomplishes his will in spite of, and sometimes even through, the failures and sins of the people who are in his plan. That God accomplishes will, I'll say that again, in spite of and sometimes through the failures and sins of the people who are in his plan. I think about Tamar, who took matters into her own hands and dressed up like a prostitute to seduce her father-in-law to have a baby with him. And then David and Bathsheba. It was a sinful situation in both of those stories. And Rahab, of course, what she's doing is not at all right in the sight of God. But the point is that it's God that's doing these things. And that sometimes, even when we are failures, sometimes even when we're not doing what we ought to do, God is still working through us. Because there is a quality about God that shines through all of this, and that is God's faithfulness. One of the things that appears over and over in the book of Genesis is that God's people are a failure. You read the story of Lot, And you read the story of Judah here in Genesis chapter 38. And then you read the story of Joseph, how his brothers wanted him dead and sold him as a slave. None of these people are being righteous people. But God's being faithful because God made a promise to Abraham. God said, I'm going to make you a great nation, and I'm going to take your people and I'm going to make them my own. And even though people are failing, even though people are doing sinful things, God is being faithful to his word. What a great God we serve. What a wonderful quality of God this is, that even when I'm not doing as I ought to do, and when you are not doing as you ought to do, when we're doing those things that are even contrary, and the very things God said not to do, that God is not going to allow that to stop him from doing what he said he will do. And he can use even the failures of his people to accomplish good things, because God is faithful. There is a third lesson that comes from all of this. And that is that desperate situations showcase the power and the righteousness of God. Because you see, the accomplishment of God's plan does not depend on human strength. It does not depend on human power. As a matter of fact, the very best place to see the righteousness and the faithfulness and the power of God is when human power is completely out of the picture. You remember the stories of the judges, don't you? That there is Gideon and Jephthah and Samson and Deborah and all of those people, Ehud. Not a one of them was worth anything in the world in which they grew up. You think of Jephthah. They all had remarkable flaws. Gideon is afraid of the enemy. Ehud is a left-handed man, which basically you'd never find in an ancient army. Jephthah is the son of a prostitute. Over and over the list goes, these judges have got some pretty serious flaws to them. And yet they are the very people that God chose through whom to deliver his people, so that when the dust settled and the smoke cleared, people would not say, wow, that Gideon was some boy, wasn't he? He was really great. Or that they would look at Jephthah and say, now that man was a born leader. No. People would look at what happened and they could only come to one conclusion, that God must have done this, because the people he was using weren't much to talk about. And that's why you see these women, I think, in the genealogy of Jesus. Tamar, in a desperate situation. You see Ruth, a Moabitess, widowed, the widowed daughter-in-law of another widow. You see Bathsheba, and you see Rahab, women of ill repute, in some senses, in the Bible. In desperate situations, Rahab's city is about to be destroyed. And it's in those desperate situations that the power of God shines through most clearly. I remind you of what the Bible tells us in the book of James. In James chapter 1 and verse 2, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. If we'd have put that into modern English, when you have desperate situations. Consider it all joy when your situation is desperate, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God. James is making the same kind of point that we see here in the Old Testament, that it's not of you. It's not up to you. It's not up to me. It's not about what we know. It's not about how strong we are. It's about God and about his faithfulness and his power and his righteousness. And sometimes the best way for us to understand that is for us to be in a desperate situation so that God's power can really shine. I think about the Apostle Paul as he mentioned to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians about all the times that he had been beat up and left for dead and run out of town and stoned and beaten and all of these other things. And Paul says, and yet I'm still here. I'm still going. What is it that keeps me alive? How is it that I'm still working and doing this work? He says, it is the power of God in me. Paul understood this lesson. Sometimes we need to understand it as well, like we studied in Psalm 57 in our Bible class this morning. Sometimes we have to be in the cave. Sometimes we have to be driven away from what is comfortable for us to understand that it is about God and about His power. And we never know how God is going to accomplish His will. Remember what God said in Isaiah? My thoughts are not your thoughts. Your ways are not my ways. Don't think that just because you can't do it that I can't do it. But there is a fourth lesson. You see, not only do you never know how God is going to accomplish His will, not only does God accomplish His will in spite of and through the failures of His people, and not only do desperate situations showcase the power of God, but number four, God is in control. Things may look messed up from our perspective, but that's not the way God looks at them. You remember the creation story? I'm sure you do. Genesis 1 and 2, but especially Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then the next thing we're told is really interesting. And the earth was formless and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Here is this great and holy God, whose works are perfect, who is beyond the calculation of wisdom. God created the heavens and the earth, and it was formless and void. It was messed up. Why would God make a world that was messed up? So that He could show us His power. And God took that world that was messed up, and He made order out of it. He made the waters separate from each other, and He made the dry land appear, and He made life and put things in their place in the heavens and on the earth, because what God does is He makes order out of chaos. And things may look messed up from our perspective. It may look like our lives are falling apart, the world is falling apart, or whatever it is, but that's not the way that God looks at things. You remember Psalm 2? We talked about that in our Bible class this morning. Why do the nations rage and the nations are in an uproar? The kings of the earth take their stand together against the Lord and His anointed. They're all in rebellion. The world is in chaos. Nobody wants to listen to God. Everybody wants to do their own thing. And God looks up above and says, it doesn't look like it's out of control to me because I'm in control. And God laughs at them. He scoffs at them. He says, I have installed my king on Mount Zion. You will not defeat him. From our perspective, it looks like things have gone haywire. But God says, everything's fine. From His perspective, He set a king that cannot be conquered, and He is going to reign and bring salvation to the people of God. God is in control, friends, and we must never forget that. You remember Revelation chapter 4 and 5, the first big vision of the book of Revelation? In a book written to Christians who were about to face persecution, whose world was going to fall apart and who were going to be confused about the way things are, and they were going to wonder why and where is God. The opening scene of the book of Revelation is God sitting on the throne in heaven as if to say to these Christians, I've got it under control. In the days to come, you may not think that from your perspective, but believe me, I am in control over the universe. You see, friends, God is always in control. Whether it looks like that from our perspective or not, He's always in control. And the important thing is not that we can see that. That's not the important thing. The important thing is that you and I be people of faith who are loyal to God. I don't know what Ruth was thinking when she said those famous words to Naomi. But I do know that she had this quality of loyalty about her. And I'm sure that Ruth sat down one day and said, you know, I don't know what's happened to my life. One day I'm married and happy, and the next day my husband's gone, and I'm following this widow into a land that's not my home. I'm sure one day Ruth just had to sit down and say, what in the world happened? But one thing about her that didn't change is she was loyal to Naomi. And I look at Rahab and I look at Ruth and I see women who decided to stand on God's side when their world was falling apart. Because they understood something that you and I need to know, and that is that it doesn't matter if we can see that God is in control. From our perspective, the world might be all wrong, but what's important is being people of faith who are loyal to God. Four women, four unusual stories, four ancestors of Jesus, four lessons about our lives. May God help us to remember these things as we live our lives in this world today.